I think that when it comes to, you know, a lot of creative departments like that, whether it be Crunchyroll or Netflix or Viz or Amazon, I think that I would like to hope that all of them are like, no, we want entertainment by human beings. But they're having people from all over, and it's just incredible. Then I see, like, you know, some of these AI things, and I'm like, no, I don't, there's no replacing this stuff that is made by all these hardworking, dedicated, extremely skilled human beings.
Hello and welcome to Culturescape, the show that interviews the geek creators and influencers that built nerd culture. I'm your host, Peter Pischke, and today I have a very special guest. He's an independent animator, a video game designer, a YouTuber, and newsground pioneer. He's one of my favorite all-time voice actors. He's Christopher Niosi, a.k.a. Kurt Buffer, the voice of Reagan Arataka from Mob Psycho 100. That's probably like one of my top three voice acting delivery performances of all time, so I'm excited.
Aww.
And Conrad Leto in the recent Black Clover film. He's the creator of Tome, the Terrain of Magical Expertise, which is an animated web series and video game. I know, it's a lot. In this episode, we're going to dive into Chris's journey as an artist, as a performer, his inspirations, his influences, his achievements of future projects and plans. I'm sure if you love Chris's work, you want to learn more about how the creative process between animation and voice acting goes, then today you're in for a treat. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you. Wow, what a start. I'm going to be that guy only because it's a common thing with me, and it's pronounced Herbifer. It's like Christopher, except Kirbier.
Oh, I made it when
screen name I made when I was like 12 years old on AOL Instant Messenger, if anybody remembers what that is. But I'm happy to be here. Thanks for reaching out.
Yeah, I know. I think I've been saying that name for as long as I knew who you were. So it's like,
wow,
10 years. You just solve it.
But you know what? More importantly, you also pronounced Niosi correctly, because I get noisy and nosy, you know, which both of which I am. I mean, you know, granted, but I signed up for this. But I'm happy to be here. Thanks so much for bringing me on your show.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you. I saw you recently also on Pipkin Pippa, and that was a fascinating interview, and you were so kind to bring it. Come on.
That was an interesting, like, 48 hours of a Twitter interaction, and then her crash in a stream, and then me getting interviewed, and it was, she's a funny little bunny, that one.
Yeah, no, she's great. She's about the only VTuber I actually will like watching. That's not really my thing. That is a crowd that you are good at tapping into. This even goes back to when you started, because, like, from everything I read, you pretty much got started as like a young mid to young teenager on Newsground in 2004. You're about my age, so you're what, like 15, 16 at most?
Yeah, I was I'd first heard about Newgrounds when I was probably like 13 or 14, I had become, I'd been introduced to Flash animation first with Homestar Runner and Strong Bad Emails and all that stuff. A buddy of mine showed that on my birthday. We had a bunch of my friends over. He said, do you got to see this funny web cartoon thing? And I was like, oh, it's hysterical. No, what did they make this? It looks a little different than the other cartoons you think. And then I remember actually I was telling kind of my like on again, off again, like school bully Flash sometimes friend in like middle school, like, oh, you see Homestar Runner? He's like, oh yeah, Newgrounds is better. And I'm like, what is Newgrounds? And so I went there and I discovered all the early stuff by guys like Joey Blanchette, Legendary Frog, John and Richie, the Zerbs brothers, the Super Flash brothers. You know, a lot of these guys I'd gone on to work with later and, you know, become friends with and stuff. They're great people. I got really intrigued by it. And then I took a class in 2004, I think it was, to learn how to work with Flash back when it was Macromedia before Adobe kind of scooped it up.
Yeah, that and just dates you a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, this is a long time ago. I think the first version I used was like MX 2004 Flash and Fireworks. I didn't even have Photoshop yet. It was very rudimentary stuff, but I picked it up, and I at the time, I really wanted to make games and learned very quickly that programming was not a fun thing for me to do at all. So I was like, I'll make movies instead. And that led to wanting to do animation. And then I went to college to do it. I went to the School of Visual Arts in New York City, did that for 4 years. The voiceover stuff kind of happened along the way. And I made a lot of amazing friends in the arts and in the acting world that have helped me with all these projects that I've done and things I've gotten to be in. And it's been quite a ride. And now here I am, 34 years old. And I've done, from your intro, I've done a little bit of everything. I've done a whole lot of stuff. And there's a lot more that I want to do. And I love every second of it. So.
Well, hopefully, I think more will be in your future. You're really great because I think the internet age brought in a lot of people, especially near the content creation space where you are taking part in all kinds of industries. And that is a talent because not everyone can juggle multiple balls. Not everyone can try to be in all the different spaces. It's fascinating to me that you got big on Newsground because that was, I remember when online content, stuff that you could watch for video streaming and enjoy, that was just around that time. We're talking about like 2004, 2005.
Yeah, because what YouTube kind of, I think, started right around, was it maybe 2005 was when YouTube started?
Yeah.
Okay. And I didn't hop on YouTube until a little bit later because I had this like, no, I'm a Newgrounds guy specifically. And then, there was a whole thing with that. And that Blip was a thing back then too.
Yep.
Or there's all these kind of alternatives. That was a whole nightmare a lot of people had to deal with. And even, in the last probably 10 years or so, I have mainly been, in terms of having the majority of my stuff, I'm mainly a YouTube guy because just out of convenience, just because you can't beat the convenience of YouTube, for better or worse. Not that it's a perfect platform, as I'm sure many people will tell you, but I enjoy having my stuff on there. I enjoy streaming. I enjoy doing shorts and stuff, TikTok type stuff. And and then when I have, like a bigger scale kind of project like Tome or otherwise, just there it goes and everybody sees it and et cetera. That and also wanting to avoid people just posting my stuff without my permission on other places anyway, which was a thing back then too. And eventually I tried to circumvent that as best as I could. So.
that was the pre Twitter thing where like a person with like 100,000 followers steals like a tweet thread from like a guy with 12.
Yeah. Recently, as I'm sure a lot of you folks know, that we have the Super Mario RPG remake happening. And so tons of people were very kindly like thinking of me because of the Rawest Forest music video that I did all the way back in 2007. I was in high school. I did that as like one of my school projects. I did it in a week and it became hyper viral. And I was pointing out that that really hit big. I put it on Newgrounds, but it hit really big on YouTube and on Nigo Nigo Douga, which is a big Japanese video site. It's kind of a YouTube sort of alternative for Japan. It went kind of viral from other people taking it. It had my name on it, so people knew it was me, thank God. And then somebody just like, when Mario RPG was trending because there were rumors, there might be a remake or something, and somebody just put Ross Forest up without asking on Twitter, just as a video file, no tagging, no credit, no nothing. And I'm like, yep, history repeats itself. And then the next morning, the remake got announced. And then my phone was blowing up. My Twitter timeline was blowing up. And I'm just like, wow. Well, you know what? It all works out. So.
No, that's great. You're just like, you've been keeping the faith. You were like one of the most hardcore Super Mario RPG fans I can think of. And you were like in the wilderness with the candle. You were just waiting for someone to come and take the Olympic flame.
For years, I was like, maybe at best we'll get Geno in Smash or something, someday. Because I really had, I dreamed of a Mario RPG remake, but I'm like, it's such a, niche little thing. There was even a recent idea that I had, I think like as the beginning of this year, about what if they did it as like a Mario and Luigi game? Like they had Luigi as an extra party member and you have the team attacks. And now we're getting, and it even kind of seems like on that trailer, that we might be getting team attacks with the characters anyway. And I'm like, oh my God, this is a dream come true, So I'm really excited to play it. It'll be, obviously we'll be about a half a year or so until it's out, but it's exciting. So
yeah, I hope it's good. Hey, Square has a pretty good, they have a pretty good track record lately for the remakes. So I don't know if it's Square
making it though. We actually don't even know who the developer, I mean, obviously it's Nintendo, you know, publishing it, but we don't know who is doing the game yet. I don't know if it's Square Enix. I know that Chihiro-san, the original director of the game, who's on Twitter, I think that he said, hey, I'm not involved with it, but I can't wait to see it. It looks like it's going to be great. So yeah, no, there's a lot that I'm very excited to see about when that project finally hits. So
yeah, we're working through your CV, what you've been working on, all the different people you've done projects with. Maybe a little jealous, because I was like, what was I doing in 2005? I know it wasn't anything nearly as productive. When I thought of Newsground, this is how it was out here in South Dakota. It was the place we went to after we were in the keyboard classes. Yeah, there were typing classes, and that was still around at that point. And then afterwards, for like 20 minutes, everyone would just hop on Newsground and then play whatever was there. They might see the videos, or they might play, like, I play a lot of like Lifesaver branded like pool and mini golf, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Newgrounds was banned pretty quickly on my school server in that era. A lot of those hot sites, people were just like, nope, the staff were just, you know, block them off of the school's internet. So, you know, that was where I went after school, was I would go home and I would, you know, be living on the internet since, you know, probably about 2002 or three was when I was really getting big into that. It's funny, even I was just talking to somebody about this the other day in Tome, in my series, there are these characters, the Net Kings, who are like the creators of the virtual world, you know, kind of MMORPG thing that the characters are hanging out with. And unlike the characters, which were mostly based on people that I knew off of like the internet, like my earliest people that I met online, the Net Kings were all based on the earliest websites that I went to. So I'd be going to like Super Mario 128 Central, which was like the site that popularized like the Luigi is in Mario 64 rumor thing that was like, that was super viral early on. Kirby's Rainbow Resort game trailers. God, you know, like Konzenshu, which was our Daizenshu back then. It was a big Dragon Ball site. You know, a lot of stuff like that I was just way, way into. And, you know, so when I go on the computer at like my dad's like office of work or something, and, you know, became really fascinated. And the internet is the best and worst thing that's ever happened to me all at once, really. So
I, you know, this is something I don't think the latest generation of gamers that, you know, it's part of the major culture. It's very normalized. I mean, there's still some people who give you trash or complain about, but it isn't like it used to be. Back in the day, though, when you and I were kids and teens, like getting accurate information about a video game was sometimes difficult. Like I remember a friend Josh me about, like, you could play Pokemon Yellow and there is a truck sitting, but you have to do like these really elaborate steps to find it. And we were like, this is how you unlock Mew 3, and it was just like all kinds of ridiculous garbage.
Yeah, I remember all that stuff. Yeah, to the point where, this is funny, I remember I was looking back on some of the old, I used to collect a massive amount of Pokemon stuff. I'm still a huge fan. That was my very first voiceover gig, was working on Pokemon in 2009. I did that show, and I remember the early like first few Gold and Silver Gen 2 Pokemon were being kind of slowly you know, teased and everything, and everybody saw Meryl and they were like, oh, it's Pika Blue.
Yes.
And literally, yes, there was like not the official the trading card game, but there was like an alternate, it was like Topps, like a baseball card brand, and they did Pokemon cards that were mostly just like screenshots from like episodes of the show or the movie. And the Mewtwo Strikes Back, the movie, had not come out in the US yet, and they had they had some of the Gen 2 Pokemon teased a little bit. Meryl was one of them. And literally, there is an official piece of Pokemon merchandise that calls Meryl Pika Blue. If you really dig for that, you can find that. It's just, I mean,
is that like a collector's item someone has? It's like,
very well might be. Yeah. I mean, there's just that. It was just a wild west of things back then. And I remember, like, yeah, a lot of those early Pokemon sites. Serebii.net, I've been going to for probably 20 years of my life at this point. You know, and other ones that I'm sure are long gone by now. And I remember like printing out pictures of of Ho-Oh that we knew as Golden Bird back then, and Togepi was new. It was the new, you know, hot thing at that time. Yeah, it was interesting. Yeah, 2000, early 2000s and late 90s internet was a very strange beast to tame, I guess.
Yeah, I imagine whoever has that card, that's like, because you hear this all the time for owning certain comic books with like rare covers or certain cards, and are like, this is my retirement. But, you know, there's some poor fool that paid $50,000 for the peak of.
Oh my God.
You went there from a teenage. By the way, how did that affect you? I've always kind of wanted to know, how did getting that big that young affect you? Because like, I'm in my 30s, and if I have a successful project, I sometimes struggle, like I contextualizing it, handling it. Like, I can't imagine if I found success as a teenager, that would just, I don't know.
Well,
you're a better man than
first,
me in that way.
My first big successful thing that I did on Newgrounds, on the internet in general, was this thing called the Super Freaking Parody Rangers, which was, of course, it was a Power Rangers parody. And that was an era, that was definitely a learning era for me, because I remember I was doing TV Tome Adventures, which was kind of the very first incarnation of Tome. And it was all just me telling a story and trying to make, like, you know, an anime emulated kind of, you know, thing, right? And so I was doing that, and then I was seeing a lot of my peers and people I looked up to getting, like, really popular, millions of views, and I'm like, I'm 17 or, you know, whatever, and I want that. Like, I want popular. And it wasn't about making money. It was about just popularity and respect, you know? So I did Parody Rangers because it was inspired by an old clip that Aaron Hansen did. It was just like making fun of Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, and I thought it was funny. So I had him do a bunch of voices on it. I worked with Chris Zito and Edwin Chong and Kira Buckland and a bunch of folks on that. A lot of people who are now working in voiceover professionally. And I did this thing because I thought, well, no one, there's all these video game parodies, but nobody's done a Power Rangers parody except for like the Mighty Moshin Emo Rangers on MySpace. That was the thing. Anybody knows what that is, you're cool and ancient. But I was trying to capitalize on an open market, basically, on something that hadn't been done before. And that was something where, like, I really shifted my motivation to that. And on one hand, as a kid, I was just excited to do stuff and to get attention and to have people like what I was doing and to have more than the very niche, very small audience of TTA watching it. Like, I wanted to expand my audience. But at the same time, I think that was also, and I've talked about this a lot on, like, in other interviews and a lot of my own videos, where it's like, that was a very, like, you know, selfishly, you know, not the greatest type of motivation. But when you're young and, you know, you're just kind of going through life and letting whatever guide you, you know, that's what I did. And then I wised up by the time I was getting through college, and I was like, you know what, this type of stuff is not what I want to be doing forever. I don't want to be doing parodies and, you know, video game, you know, tribute stuff. By the way, it's fun to do, you know, mm-hmm. and I like, because that's the difference between, say, like with the Mario RPG music videos. Like, those are things that are just pure passion. Like, I love that game and I just want to make something to express how much I love it, you know? And the fact that it became popular, like, as a result, like, well, that's the bonus, you know? And now, you know, what I really care about is, it's ironic, because I do really care about making money because, you know, I got to eat. Certainly, but yeah,
true.
No, I care more than anything about just making something that is positively influential and inspiring and cool and memorable and entertaining to people. You know, it's not about chasing trends. And if I'm doing that, then it's like very simple, you know, like curb blocks, like little quick like videos or shorts and things that I can do in 2 seconds. But that isn't like a passion project. It's just a little content. So
yeah, part of the content factory we now all have to be.
Oh, yeah.
No, and I would spin that, though, that I would say that seeking out popularity, it may not be just like, I guess that's kind of like almost an American high school kind of thing. That's kind of how we think of popular. But I would say it's also you built something lovingly and you would want it to be appreciated. I know that's how it's for me. I want my projects to do as well as I can, but it's not really because I want people to like me per se. Maybe there is some of that. I mean, I'll be honest.
But I mean, I definitely, well, in that same area you were talking about, I mean, yeah, I wanted to be friends with all the the guys that were, you know, the bigwigs and stuff. And I did eventually get to know. And you know what? Admittedly, even, you know, at that time when I was young and stupid and overeager and came off, a big thing that I regret of that time was that I came off as very arrogant to people. I've never had, I mean, I feel confident and proud of the work that I do for the most part, but I don't feel like up, you know, my own butt about what I do. I don't consider myself like, you know, some kind of like savant or god of what I do. No, I don't have that. I don't have that in me. I don't have like an egotistical thing about me, but I came off that way a lot in my annoyingness and overeagerness and, you know, petulance and everything. Mm. And that rubbed some people that were, you know, my colleagues the wrong way. But there were other people that I'm still friends to this day. Like I think of guys like Happy Harry and the Super Flash Brothers and guys like that, that I met during that time that I think understood that like I was an overeager kid, because also we were all jerks, you know, like actually Chris O'Neill and Zach Hadel, who now are friends as well. I saw Chris for dinner like a, you know, month or two ago. And we've worked together on various things.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, there was a time.
Guys.
Oh, yeah. Like there was a time where we were like at each other, like in like, you know, reviews and just, you know, our fans kind of feuding. And then we just kind of woke up at like sometime in our mid-20s and we're just like, this is stupid. Sorry. Like, I'm sorry, too. You want to hang out and high five and be friends? And then we did. You know, you grow up after a while. So.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think of the term, but, you know, scientists have shown that the stage of the brain development for males for your frontal cortex, which is what helps control your urges. It's basically what allows you to pass the marshmallow test. That doesn't develop till much later than ladies. It's like mid-20s. And for some people, it's even later. So, and then here's the thing. I think for you, I've watched enough and I've listened to enough of you. I think we're similar in personality. Do you watch One Piece, by the way?
I adore One Piece.
Okay, so
yeah,
you will get
absolutely.
This analogy. So in One Piece, there's the character of Brook, who's my favorite One Piece character by far, because Ian Sinclair is he's really
brilliant.
Good in that role.
He's genius. Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Brook's problem, though, and I think Oda, this is true in the manga, and he handles it so well, is Brook, because he was socially isolated for so long, he doesn't understand a lot of how his mannerisms and how he behaves reflects on other people. And the Straw Hats, they know he means well and they understand it, so they get it. But other people may not. And I think that's true for a lot. You know, I spent most of my teens and my 20s. I know I come from an abusive single family household situation. So most of that time when I wasn't doing school, I was, you know, trying to help take care of my siblings. The problem is, though, as an adult, I even try to do journalistic projects, or I try to hang out with other people who are into journalism. I still have some of that. I still have some of that, like that social isolation, that inability to know when I come off sounding ego or arrogant. So I don't blame you at all for having that problem. I think a lot of people actually do. I just don't think I don't think people are really comfortable getting into it. And that's not a huge focus, but I just want you to know, I don't think you should be so hard on yourself necessarily.
Well, no, you know what? It's not to be hard on oneself. I think it's to know your roots. I think that because especially like as someone who did basically grow up on the internet, and as a lot of my, you know, my friends and colleagues have, you know, it's a very weird thing where like, it's like everything that you do and say is chronicled in some way, and in like it's stamped in some place on the information superhighway, and it's archived somewhere, even if you think it isn't. And so the person that you were 1 year, 3 year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years ago, like no matter, you know, even, you know, people change identities. I never felt the need to do that personally, but it's all there, and I think that the good and bad side of that is it's like, well, you know, you get reminded of like, yep, that was who I was back then. But it's also like, you know what? But I'm not that anymore.
And yeah, I'm no longer 15.
I grow. Yeah. Yeah. Now I'm not Kerber for, even though that's my YouTube screen name is Kerber for 15, because I made it when I was 15. And now I'm Kerber for 34 at this point. So maybe I'll reach Kerber for 150. I'll tap a zero on it, but I live a really healthy life.
It would be funny though if your career was like mirrored, so like you kind of started making the Newsground cartoons, and there was that was 2000s era humor, some of it, and uh-huh. It's like the arc of your career. It goes really high, and then before you die, you're back to Newsground.
Yeah, Newgrounds will somehow resurface again and actually become more popular than any other video site.
Yes.
And that'll be, because you know what? What I will say,
long,
it's still
it's
active.
The long play.
It's still active. And what I can still appreciate about Newgrounds is the fact that, like, it is, it's because the whole kind of subtitle of it is Newgrounds, everything by everyone. And it's freedom. It's anybody could post music, art, animation, games, you know, writing, anything. It's all there. And I really loved that. And Tom Fulp and all the staff over at Philly, who I haven't seen in a long time, you know, they made something really special that I think is a really, really important part of internet history, you know. And I learned a lot there, and I'm happy with, you know, most of what I did back then. But I'm happier also doing what I'm doing now as well.
Oh, and you're very good at it. One thing I think, and I would like, voice acting is the main thing I love you for. Reagan Arataka is one of my favorite performances, I think, in English. I know, but it's just, and that's, you know, it's obviously a big reason is because that character is written so well.
Uh-huh.
The ADR director, whoever put together the script, all of it is just perfect. But also your delivery. Yeah. I think you give a delivery of a very cocky but surefire kind of upper baritone.
Big Jim Carrey energy was what I brought to that role for sure.
And I think it's fantastic. So when you agreed to come on, I was like, oh, that's so exciting. So, but one thing I do like you, and this is something I wish people who don't work in media, who don't create content, is like so much of your time is devoted to networking. So much of your time is like trying to connect with other people. And it's almost this no-win situation where it's like you have to behave a certain way. Otherwise, people won't like you. But at the same time, you also be careful because it's like, will they let you in the inner circle, into the inner clique? And what you, I know what you are really good at, because this is true of Tome. It's like you have all these pretty well-to-do, either they're content creators or the people in animation. And that, I, being someone that's worked in media, I know that is a particular skill. And I know a lot of people who want to get into media or content creation struggle to understand that. Can you give us a little insight? Like, is that something naturally you're very good at? Or what's your philosophy when you're trying to network? Or maybe it's just totally organic and they're like, oh, you're my friend, let's do this.
You know, well, it is certainly a bit of that. You know, I think that, in entertainment, I think a lot of people talk about like, oh, it's all nepotism. It's all who you know. And I think that's true, but I think that's also a very cynical way of looking at it, because like I think that it is sometimes not even just friendship. Sometimes it's also a level of like admiration for someone else. You know, I've been recommended and you know, given opportunities by people that sometimes I've never met before, or people that I only know very vaguely, but they know of my work. I've done the same for some people that I've, you know, hardly met, but like, because, you know, a lot of people know I'm kind of a walking, talking, like, encyclopedia of voiceover stuff. So like, I know who everybody is. And a lot of them I also know personally to some level, not everybody, but like, you know, I love that. I love that kind of stuff. And the rare times I get to cast, you know, projects and things. I was actually just helping somebody cast, something like about a month ago. And there were people in that case where I'm like, you know what, I've never worked with this person, but I love their work and they should be part of this project, you know, kind of thing like that. So, but as far as my own way of doing that, I know it's going to sound very simplistic, but it's really as simple as just like, I ask people and usually they say yes. There's very, very few people that I've reached out to about, hey, I'd love to work with you on this. And they'll be like, oh, I'm not interested, or oh, I don't have time, or oh, sorry, I can't do this. Like, it's very rare. Most people, ones that I'm shocked by, that will be like, oh, yeah, I'd be happy to do that for you. And whether it's voiceover or guesting with animation or doing music or art, you know, backgrounds and stuff, like anything. And I think that, I mean, as far as like my knack goes for it, I mean, some of it was lessons learned. I mean, actually from that same era of like, you know, how learning, like, how do people like to be approached? I think even like when you're trying to break into a business, a lesson that I learned from someone was about how the entertainment business is populated by gatekeepers. And I don't mean that in like a negative way. It's like, that's the position that they're placed in terms of, they are, you know, either a decision maker or they represent a decision maker, and it's their job to filter, you know, the people that are deemed like you need to be involved with this, and these people don't need to be involved with it. And I think that when you want to break through that, you have to understand how would a gatekeeper want to be approached? And I think that understanding that level of etiquette about something, here's an example. Mona Marshall, who is a great friend, and a lot of people know of her as she was Izzy in Digimon. She's a lot of the female characters on South Park. And she was the lead character in the Dot Hack video game, which Dot Hack was a huge influence on Tom. I wanted to get a hold of her and have her do a guest character in one of the episodes. So I went to a friend that I worked with who was a radio host and interviewed Mona. And I said, hey, how could I get in touch with Mona? And she said, I usually go through people's agencies. So try doing that and see if you can get a hold of her. And I did. Funnily enough, now I'm with that agency, that very same one. And I reached out to Mona and said, hey, Mona, I'm an independent artist. I really love your work, specifically for your work in as Kite in the Dot Hack video games. I'm making this animated project that was very heavily inspired by Dot Hack. It's a small role, would be maybe an hour of your time. It would mean the world to me to get to work with you. If you'd be interested, let me know. And she got back to me like within a matter of days. And we worked together over Skype. And she, oh, you're moving to LA? Let me know. I'd love to hook you up with some opportunities. Like, and I'd love to work with you. I want to produce some animation stuff myself. And I'm like, oh my God, wow. And that was just from like reaching out and being professional and cool about it. You know, being professional during the recording session that we had. And she did this little character in one of the episodes. And then, you know, we've had a friendship for 9 years now. And she's great. And like, that's, you know, a lot of cases have been like that, you know, with people that are a lot of which are my very good friends. And I work with and see, you know, all the time, every other week or so. So sometimes it's as simple as that. It's not, you know, if I dig to try and find like, what is my secret? Like, I don't know. I just approach people and usually they're cool about it. So
the big thing that I know, and I actually, it's so crazy because I vaguely remember who Kerbifer was when I invited you, but mostly I knew you from your voice acting career. And then I was like, oh, I was like, he was the Newsground guy that he did like the brawl taunts and he did this and he did that. I was like, oh my gosh, it is. It was so weird. It was a blast from the past.
It's always funny to see how I like kind of fit into people's lives. Of like what they know me from specifically, because it's like some corners of the internet, it's like the Brawl Tots guy, and some people are like, oh, Alex from Y2K, and like, oh, like Tom, or oh, you know, Mob Psycho, or you know, what have you. Like, it's always a different thing with people, or you know, oh, the Mario RPG thing, etc. And it's fascinating to see like the differences. And like when I meet someone, I go, oh, I know who you are, and I'm like, what do you know me from? Is always what I want to know first and foremost. So
yeah, no, that's kind of a nice feeling though. It feels nice to be appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
Your thing about the gatekeeper though makes sense. I don't even know how I got into it, but I'm in a bunch of Facebook groups for voice acting and it's like full to the brim of people trying to break into that industry. I swear it's like thousands, if not tens of thousands of people are trying to do what you do. So when you said that about there has to be gatekeepers, that's kind of what I'm thinking of. It's like, there are so many people that want to get into this. That would mean that someone has to figure out who could be in here, who isn't. And that doesn't always, I think, come out fair to people, but that, you know, that's just reality. That's life. What you're going to do. How did you move from guy on Newsground, does some animation? You even worked with Skullgirls at one point, I believe, but that's,
I did, yeah.
That's a whole other thing right now.
Right.
How did you move from all that kind of stuff to being like professional voice actor? What was the flip? How did you get your chance, your big chance? How did that happen for you?
Well, so I don't have a traditional acting background. I did not do theater or radio or stand up or any of that stuff. I was an animator first and foremost, and I did voices for some of my own things. And probably around, I guess probably middle school for me, I learned about voice actors and got really intrigued by them, and I became, you know, like I became this big encyclopedia of who all of them were. You know, there was this website, TV Tome, which was where I met all the people that the Tome characters were like originally based on way, way back in the first incarnation. And it was kind of like a Wikipedia-ish sort of site that had like information on every TV show and movie, including all the staff and actors. And that's where I learned, oh, the guy who voices SpongeBob is also like Dog from CatDog and all this, you know, et cetera. And I started building that up. And then I was finding like behind the scenes stuff, commentaries and, you know, interviews and things with different voice actors and really finding that fascinating. And so I was kind of just studying like, why? Oh, okay. What makes this performance good? And what makes this performance bad? Like, why do I love this, but I don't love this? And so I became really studious of it. And then when I started doing voices for my own stuff, that was kind of what I was taking and integrating into that, was trying to use what I had learned with someone that didn't have like a performance background, to determine what makes a good performance that is funny or believable or dramatic or effective in eliciting whatever it needs to elicit from the audience, right? And having that in tandem with creating and writing and animating my own stuff that went with it kind of helped guide that a bit. Then my opportunity was I was starting to go to conventions. I would meet people. A lot of people in the business, a few people in the business sort of knew who I was already, because I was known on the internet for various things, and they knew me, you know, some of them knew me from like forums. Chris Bevins, actually, who's a great ADR director, and he's a friend as well. He knew me from a forum that, you know, some of the industry folks would go to kind of get feedback from people about like when new anime dubs would come out, say, hey, what'd you guys think? And hey, here's some of the, you know, cast and stuff. And just, you know, but, I went to a convention and there were two ADR directors in New York that were hosting it. And there was a panel they were doing where you'd come up. It was like a contest where you'd come up and do a monologue and then you'd have to improv and then you would have to dub a scene. Right. And I went to this contest on a whim and I won it. And the prize was supposed to be that you get a part in one project that those two directors were working on. One of them was going back and forth between New York and LA a lot, so they didn't have anything. And the other one was directing Pokemon at the time. This was back when Diamond and Pearl was the season that was being dubbed. And so, but I couldn't just be given a part. I had to earn it and audition for it like any other actor, which frankly I prefer because I think that if I had just been given like a little one episode, quick, you know, one and done thing, then I would have not had a career. Because when I was called in for my very first audition was for the character Riley, the guy with the Lucario in Diamond and Pearl, which I did not get. But I remember the director said, I know that we owe you because of that contest, but like, I wouldn't really call you in for the show if I didn't think you were good. And I was like, wow. Okay. So, it'd been a whole year since I won that contest. And then I had another audition, which turned out to be for Corey, who is this character that was representing the Gold and Silver remake that was coming out of the DS at that time. So I went and I did that, booked the part, did 5 episodes of the show. And I was like, oh my God, I did I just got my dream show that I grew up with and I'm good. But then other opportunities came up. I was getting recommended by other people for video game stuff in New York, some things from home. Then I started working for NYAV Post, did some stuff with them in New York. And then eventually I moved out to LA in 2014. And I had a lot of people like Mona, who I mentioned, and like Ben Diskin and Yuri Lowenthal, who helped, you know, shop me around to places, to different studios. And I had my little demo and everything. I just started getting more auditions. I did Tales of Zestiria right around when I moved, and Lull in the Sea and Disgaea 5 and stuff, you know, a whole bunch of different things. Then OKKO and Cartoon Network worked out. Because Ian Cordy remembered me and called me in to be a, like a utility player for a bunch of characters and things, which was...
That is interesting. What did he remember you from? From your Newsground days or from
So this was crazy. Okay, so Ian Cordy, those of you who don't know Ian Cordy, he's the creator of OKKO and the voice of Radicles and many other characters. And he was also one of the
Cartoon Network animator.
Oh, yeah. Worked on Venture Brothers and Secret Format Awesome. And he was also one of the co-exec producers on Steven Universe. Great, great guy. He was a substitute teacher for one of my animation classes in college. He was subbing in while our main animation teacher, Celia Bullwinkle, was a great animator as well. She was out one day and she called in Ian to teach us. I knew of Ian for an old Flash animation series he did called Knockfort that he did back in the mid-2000s. And so I met him there. And then I would run, and also Rebecca Shooker, who created Steven Universe, she was 2 years ahead of me at school, so I knew her from school as well. And they both kind of went out to LA around the same time, and they were doing all their animation stuff. Steven Universe and OKKO, when it was called Lakewood Plaza Turbo, got pilots picked up around the same time, and I think 2013 or so, maybe a little earlier than that. So I would see them at conventions. I would catch them at like Anime Expo once in a while, and we'd talk for a little bit, you know. And then I remember when I did Tales of Zestiria, and that came out in 2015, and that was my first like big title that I got to be part of, you know, like when I moved to LA. And I remember Ian commenting on that, and he was like, "Dude, that's awesome, good for you." Months pass, the series for OKKO was just about to start gearing up. They were doing these shorts and an iPad game, kind of to sort of begin the, it was kind of this multimedia sort of experimental thing Cartoon Network was doing. And one day, I get a DM from Ian on Twitter, and he's like, are you in the union? Because I want you on my show. And I'm like, what? And this is not how this usually happens, by the way. So I join the union, and I get an agent. I'm in the booth, and I go into Cartoon Network, and I'm there with Jim Cummings and David Herman from Futurama and Mary Elizabeth McGlynn and Ashley Birch and me. And I'm like, what is my life? What am I doing here? And it was just, it was as simple as Ian was like, "Oh, I saw you were doing voice stuff." And I'm like, "Yeah, Chris does a lot of cool character voices and stuff. He'd be good to do." Like, I did like 5 or 6 different guys in KO. I did about like 20 to 30 episodes of 100 or so that we did of that show. And that was one of the greatest joys of my life, was getting to be part of that series. So,
oh, no, I liked OKKO. I feel a little bad for that show because it came out just as the big attention for Cartoon Network was winding down. So I kind of felt like it didn't get quite as much attention as maybe it deserved.
It's got its fan base. I think a lot of people enjoy it. And, you know, and even like, I know we wanted to do a lot more with it. You know, we did, but we had a good, I mean, 3 seasons is also still a pretty good run. And like, the staff worked hard to fit all the ideas that they wanted to do into the final season as much as possible. And thankfully, because it's, you know, it's kind of a wacky show, like the kind of haphazard pace still worked for it. And I was just, yeah, it was a lot of fun. And I got to be there from pretty much beginning to end of the full series. And, you know, all the actress I got to work with, it was just a tremendous honor to be. And I would always go over to the animation building and I would see what the staff was cooking up. I learned about the Sonic crossover episode before they were doing it. And I was like, "Whoa, I can't wait to see that," you know. And I missed that show dearly. And you know, but Ian and all the staff, you know, Parker, he's now the creator of Mau Mau. You know, he was one of the artists on that show as well. A lot of people have gone on to do other great things at this point. So, you know.
So how did you the role, I think, that you are most known for is probably from Mob Psycho, though you were recently in the Black Clover film and you have had mid to big parts. Like, you were the lead on the Godzilla. There were like 3 animated Godzilla films.
Trilogy. That was a lot of fun too. I love those movies. I've had some good ones. I mean, Hunter x Hunter was a big one.
Yeah, you play the evil butterfly dude.
Yes, Chowapoof of the King's Royal Guards. He was great. I mean, you know, I've gotten to do little small characters on like some of the big shonen stuff. I mean, you know, I've done Dragon Ball, I've done One Piece, I've done Naruto, you know, and like that. That's, I know that those are small characters, but it's still just to get to be in them. Sailor Moon, I did Pegasus, and the redub we did of the original series was a tremendous honor. But yeah, Mob Psycho, I mean, yeah, for sure. I mean, Reagan is probably not going to be topped for like, and you know what? And I mean, he's a great great character to be associated with because he's just so much fun and everybody loves him. And he's such a big highlight of the show. And I'm a big fan of the show personally anyway. Like I love it. I really, really genuinely love Mob Psycho. So it's, you know, but there's worse things to be associated with, really.
No, it's a great role. You did a good job. It stands up. There are only a handful of roles like that where I think they you know, that I watch it and then years later I'm thinking about it again.
Yeah, that was really good.
You know, it's kind of like like almost all the cast of Cowboy Bebop, for example. Those are those are performances that, you know, you're like, wow.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It holds with you. So how did you, you know, maybe people are tired to hear about voice acting. I don't know. How did you get the role of Reagan Arataka? What did you do to prepare? Were you aware of the manga or the Japanese sub before that?
So I had known One Punch Man. I had auditioned for all the big characters in One Punch Man, never got on the show. And I knew vaguely that there was another series by One Sensei that was after that. And I vaguely remember seeing this dude in a suit who looked like Ichigo from Bleach if he kind of like pushed his hair down with a whole lot of Aquanet. And that was all I knew. And I was told actually by a friend of mine about how, there's this character in this show that you'd be really good for. And I'm like, I don't want to get my hopes up. And like, I don't often play lead guys in a lot of these kind of shows. I'm usually like, you know, little side dudes or whatever. And so I get the audition. And it was, you know, like, I'm sure you've probably heard this a lot too, but it really was as simple as just, it was an audition and I got it. I don't know how many other people I might've been up against for that part. I imagine probably a fair amount. But I just, you know, did two takes of him and on the audition, it was, the two scenes were him on the phone yelling at Mob to not give into the telepathy club, like, oh, they're just trying to get you to join their club, like, see through it, Mob. And then the other one was giving the one customer like the sorcery, the massage and everything.
Yeah, one of Reagan's special moves.
This is one of Reagan's special techniques. So I did those two parts, sent it in, and then I got it. And the full first season of the show was out. So I watched it in Japanese and got, you know, familiar with all the material. And we probably spent about 8 hours of recording on the first episode because I have so many lines. And we had Mami Okada, the casting director there. We had a rep from Crunchyroll, pre-merger kind of Crunchyroll way back. What year was that? We did Mob Psycho. It was 2016 or 17, I think we did.
Yeah, the first season comes out in 2016, I think.
Yeah. So we had everybody there, and Chris Kaysen, who was our ADR director for the first and second season, who I'd worked with, I think, before that on a couple other things as well. And we just went to town, and we had Mike McFarland writing it as well. And they had done, Mike and Chris had done One Punch Man as well. So they wanted some of the same staff. And there were even a couple of that, you know, Max Metalman, who was Saitama, was in Mob Psycho as well. There were a few crossover cast members there. And I just had a ball. You know, we blasted through those episodes and, you know, had them come out week to week, and it blew up. And the fact that it was a dub that was so beloved by people really meant a lot to me, because I was understanding that, you know, with the convenience of simuldubbing and simulcasting and everything, there was a lot of this stuff happening with, like, you know, people that, even people that liked dubs, but if a show would come out and there'd be the, you know, the sub episode, and maybe they didn't want to wait, they wouldn't wait. Be like, I'll just watch this, whatever. Mm-hmm. I'll watch out now. And if they didn't like the show that much, they wouldn't have much reason to go and watch it again in English. But with Mob Psycho, the show was already popular, and then the dub turned out really well and people loved it. And then by the time, I remember the second season, there were a lot of people I was keeping an eye on, like Reddit and various places. They were like, I'm gonna wait until the dub comes out for season two before I watch it. And that is not a thing that people do these days. That's very, very rare for people to do that. I do that with I wait for the dub episodes of My Hero and Dr. Stone to come out. I don't watch it in Japanese. I usually wait till the dub happens. And but I understand that for most people, they don't want to wait. They just want to see it like immediately. And if they like it enough that they'll watch the dub later, maybe they will, maybe they won't. So yeah, the adoration that people had for that show and for the dub specifically, not even just my work, but just the entire, because everybody did a great job. There was like nobody in that dub did a bad job as far as I'm concerned. And yeah, so it's lasted, you know, long time at this point. I mean, put the math on that, 7 years at this point. People have really loved it, and I really appreciate it. So
yeah, no, it's good. I was watching it last night to get ready for the interview. My mom was visiting and she watched, and she does not like anime, so but she was even enjoying it. So I was like, okay, well, maybe he did a good job. Maybe it's not just me if one of the normies likes this too.
It crosses the border between normal and anime. I think you know what? It's funny because I think it is a very accessible kind of show. You know, it's not, and because it's not too long, it's not too insane or anything necessarily. And it's just a fun time, just a good time, that show. You know?
Definitely. Season three, they were able to bring back the original voice actor, yeah, that was playing Kageyama. I read that was like a union thing. Was it something like that?
Yeah, it was a whole unfortunate issue. And Kyle McCarley, who is the original voice of Mob, is a good friend of mine. I care about him very much, and I understood his decision. I decided to take the offer to come back because they approached us all to reprise our parts. And because it was such a, I mean, the short version is because it was such an important character to me, and the show was very important to me, I decided to come back. And everybody in the cast, we all talked about it, you know, a lot about when those negotiations were going on. And you know, there was no judgment between anybody. We all love each other very much, and we're all colleagues and friends, and we work together on other projects and things. And you know, and I mean, Kyle is like on fire with his career. You know, I was very sad, of course, to not have my mob with me in the third season. You know, but like I'm proud of Kyle for just doing his thing, sticking to his guns, and making a great career for himself. Like he's on the show Monkey Kid, which if you've not seen Lego Monkey Kid, please do yourself a favor and watch that show. It's incredible. And Kyle plays this really bratty kind of like pseudo sort of villain, but I feel like he's kind of leaning towards the good side, named Red Sun, and he's just hysterical. It's so good. He does a great job on that. And you know, and getting to work on the third season was still, even though the circumstances were not perfect, obviously, because of the situation, it was still great to work on it. I worked with Caitlin Glass, who was our ADR director for third season, and she was one of the very first people in the business I ever met. She's wonderful, and she, you know, just tried to do her best with taking on the show and everything. And, you know, there were a lot of people that did come back and some people that didn't, for the same reasons that Kyle didn't. And, you know, so, yeah, it's not a perfect run all the way through, and that is a shame. I mean, that's happened with a lot of shows that I've been a fan of too. It's happened with Dragon Ball and Pokemon and Sonic multiple times, where like, and now suddenly the voices are different and etc. So I understand the frustration with that with fandom too, and it's a bummer. But you know, we just all try to do our best with things and make light of every situation we can. So
the business side of it for voice acting is like a lot of creative endeavors. It seems like it's very similar to what we're seeing with the writer's strike.
A lot of crossover there for sure.
There is definitely, and maybe I'd be interested to hear this, your thoughts on this, because there seems to be one of the issues with the writer's strike they're facing right now is, of course, the rise of AI. And it's looking at the value of artistic workers, artistic content, where from the business side, and these aren't, sometimes the business people do love whatever the medium is that they're working. Not always though. And many of them are like, well, can we, you know, could computers just do all this for us? Like what's the trade-off here? Like,
yeah,
maybe the quality's a little diluted, but we'll make oodles of money. What's your feelings on this stuff with AI? Where, how do you or your fellow voice actors feel like the horizon for what you're trying to do? Crunchyroll, which is now owned by Funimation, which is now owned by Crunchyroll, which is now owned by Sony.
Well, yeah. Crunchyroll is basically, the new Crunchyroll is basically Funimation absorbed Crunchyroll, and they've all kind of merged together and all that. And then the headquarters is the Dallas studio and all that stuff, as far as I understand. And they're all, you know, working together. And you know what? I mean, like, to speak with about them as well, like, they're just working hard to, you know, bring everybody the best that they can bring, you know, and trying to, you know, keep up with a market that's constantly evolving and changing. And I think that when it comes to, you know, a lot of creative departments like that, whether it be Crunchyroll or Netflix or Viz or Amazon, I think that I would like to hope that all of them are like, no, we want entertainment by human beings. You know, I'll be as devil's advocacy about this. There we go. I'm sure that there are uses for artificial intelligence in art and creative stuff that can be useful and helpful to people. But I don't think it will ever, and I don't ever want it to be a replacement for a real human performer. You know, I watch, you talked about One Piece earlier. I'm watching the episodes that Crunchy have been putting out of the Wano arc. And I'm just, for 20 years or however long it's been at this point, close to it, of hearing these, you know, Colin Klinkenbeard and all the cast doing these characters. And I'm like, I never get tired of this. On the other side, the animation that the people at Toei, like a lot, I believe it's a lot of the guys that did the Broly Dragon Ball Super movie a couple of years ago that are doing the episodes of One Piece, and they're getting Ian Cordy, calling back to that. He just started to do animation for one of the recent episodes of One Piece.
I saw that on Twitter.
Like, they're having people from all over, and it's just incredible. And I'm like, then I see, like, you know, some of these AI things, and I'm like, no, I don't, there's no replacing, like, this stuff that is made by all these hardworking, dedicated, extremely skilled human beings that I aspire to be, you know. It just blows my mind to see that. And so, yeah, I don't know. I don't want us to get replaced by algorithms and you know, what robotics that are trained to think that we want or need or whatever. I'd rather kind of figure it out. I'd rather us all, as we, you know, grow up and become creators and, you know, choose to do this with our lives, that we just, you know, figure out what is the human can do. Like, even, you know what, weird kind of full circle thing as well, but like, as I became a storyteller and I started, you know, making different projects and things, you know, even like the three different incarnations of Tome that I've made, right? I wanted to figure out, what am I saying with this story, right? And with each version, I got closer and closer to figuring that out. And it wasn't until I did the Tome video game that I realized, oh, I'm telling a story about trust. Now I have impetus. And that was my guiding light for writing the story of the RPG that we created a couple of years ago. And I loved how it turned out, because once I had that as the core theme of, like, it's trust and how different people deal with that, that was really like, this is what I want to be the impact that it leaves on people. This is what I want my work to do for people. You know what I mean? And even the stuff I'm working on right now, I think about, like, yeah, it's the same thing. I want these things to leave a positive impact. And it's the same thing with my voice work. It's the same thing with when I'm writing for people. It's the same thing with when I'm reading and drawing and animating and making a full, you know, product of something. That's what I want. I don't know. I don't think that AI can reproduce that personally. So
I hear you, and I am skeptical, because I work in news, and I have seen lots of people be replaced recently. I'm a little concerned, because I'm like, now
that's my hope. That's my great white hope. Is that we won't be replaced. That's what I want. But who knows? You know, I don't make a lot of those decisions, you know, from the powers that be of any shank.
But, I think voice acting, the advantage you have, though, is that people are very much tied to listening to your voices, and they want to know it's authentic. Whereas in news, it's less about, I mean, there are a few people where it is about the person, but generally it's about the content. And so the trade-offs there are way different. I think I see a lot of the technology, and it does excite me for the future. And you being a geek, I'm sure you have some of those feelings as well. It's like, I love or used to love the Big Finish Doctor Who audios, which I don't know if you're familiar with, but basically Big Finish is this British company that was, it took, grabbed all the old actors from the original Doctor Who shows.
Okay.
So they like Tom Baker, for example. And then they would have them do new stories. Of course, they're audio only. Now that technology, now the problem is though, Tom Baker, who is in his 80s, one day Tom Baker will not be with us. And that will be a problem for Big Finish. Now, Big Finish has tried to record as many things as they possibly can. That's my understanding. But by the same token, you know, there are a lot of people who can do decent impersonations. And there would be that temptation, I think, to be like, okay, let's get our decent impersonation. Let's get our AI Tom Baker, put it together. But I'm like, okay, that's kind of cool. But then it's also kind of creepy. It's like what we're seeing now with the Disney or WB who decide they wanted to use Christopher Reeve in their new Flash film. And it's like, I don't know. It's getting to a level where I'm like, I'm getting a little uncomfortable here.
Yeah.
This is getting the necromantic
or like the Darth Vader thing, you know, with James Earl Jones a little while ago. I'm just like, you know, that's your decision. But I mean, I'd rather it just be like, you know, any of the two or three different voice actors that have been, you know, when James Earl Jones doesn't do Darth Vader, like for video games or, you know, animated stuff or anything, I'd rather it just be one of those guys to just, you know, do an impression. Like, even, you know, here's something, a perspective of mine that changed. Whenever I'd see like fan made content and, you know, like impressions videos and things, like, I'm such a snob about that where I'm just like, yeah, it's okay, I guess, whatever. You know what? I'd rather a bad impression, because at least it's a human being just like having fun and experimenting around, as opposed to like, let me take, you know, samples of Sonic's voice and then make this AI thing without their permission or without any kind of whatever. Like, it's just, it's dangerous, you know, and it's disrespectful. It's uncool. You know, I've had a couple cases like that where that's happened, and I've asked people like, hey, would you mind taking it down and not doing that again? And usually people are like, I'm so sorry about that. You know, just very, you know, kind of them to be understanding of that. Yeah, I don't know. I will say, there are people in our industry that are fighting to protect us, to make sure that, you know, there are changes made and there's protection put in place, so that we are not mistreated and, you know, misused, and our property, our identities are not, you know, misused and for anything. Because yeah, it's, sometimes it can be a little bit of a wild west with things, but so I just try to hope for the best. And I mean, all I can do is just continue to contribute human made arts to the world in whatever form I can, and hope that people will enjoy it.
No, I hear you. It is a kind of it's an amazing time we're living in, but it's also, the future is very uncertain, especially for things that are artistic. Now, one of the other things that you do, you are also a game designer in the sense that you would help with voice work, or you were an animator. You've also made your own animated web series, and then that later got turned into a video game. Is being a professional animator everything you hoped it would be when you were a little 15-year-old Chris and you were making your Power Rangers parody video?
Well, it's funny because, I mean, I know that I always wanted to create things. But being an animator specifically was not like the ultimate goal. It's really more of just a piece of the bigger puzzle. You know, like when I was a kid, I dreamed of, you know, making my own shows and movies and games and things. And but I wasn't going to sit around and wait for, you know, somebody to give me $1 million and make something. So I strove to learn every part of the process that I possibly could, to do all the stuff that I needed to make those end products. So animation was just a large part of that, you know, piece of the puzzle. And like I mentioned earlier, when I got into using Flash, it was just a necessity of like, all right, if I'm going to make stuff, then part of how it's got to go, you know? And so I did that, and I continued to improve, and then obviously I went to school for it and everything. And being an animator, it's really just that it's allowed me to do what it is that I want to do ultimately, which is to create an end, finished, complete product. And I know how to work with other people on all the things that I don't know how to do, you know, or I'm not as good at doing, you know. And what I get to do freelance, you know, like animation stuff for other people or otherwise, It's fun to do, and it's an honor to be part of projects like Skullgirls. That was tons of fun to do that, and very cool that I can point to, like, you know, when Miss Fortune, you know, pops her head off and paws around it like it's like a little ball of yarn. I'm like, I got to animate that. You know, I got to work with, you know, Mariel Cartwright and like the hundreds of like really amazing cleanup animators and all these people that worked so hard to make that game like extra special and just beautiful looking. You know, that's awesome to get to do that. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, in terms of like all I dreamed of, yeah, I didn't dream of it in that way. And to be honest, I mean, like if I had so much money to spare, I mean, I would rather, you know, pay other people to do animation for me and just, you know, work with them on what I need. Like, you know, I've done that with character design and background environment design, sorts, you know, music, all sorts of things. And I love working at a team. That's one of the biggest joys of doing this, you know?
No, definitely. And I can, you know, getting, you know, interviewing you, for example, you know, I've been a geek and a nerd all my life. When I get to interact with, you know, people that I've admired or their work, and you get to engage in that content, it does feel special because you have a great appreciation. I'm sure that's a lot of it is how it is for you, because you grew up, for example, I know you're a huge Mega Man kind of Nintendo fan. You're kind of in that area. And one of the interesting things I noticed that you did with Tome the Video Game is you were able to track down the guy that did the Mega Man X voice, I believe. And I don't think I've heard him since. No,
it was, I had the voice of Mega Man from Mega Man 8, who was like the
Bass, why are we fucking? We are not enemies.
I found her. She was in Japan, Ruth Shirishi, Ruth German. And also the voice of Zero from Mega Man X8. Lucas Gilbertson. Yeah, who he's still doing. He and his partner Caroline Day, they're still doing voiceover work up in Calgary. They're great people, and they're making video games and stuff now themselves. Really cool stuff. But Lucas is awesome. I met Lucas many years ago, and he's a great voice actor and tons of fun, and he loves Zero and everything. So, you know.
The kind of games you like seem similar to me, where it's kind of a hate-love relationship, because it's like, you know, are we ever going to see actually new Mega Man games? I am not certain.
Hey, you know what? Look, we had Mega Man 11 a few years ago, which was a victory, and Battle Network Legacy Collection appears to be very, very successful. So there's clearly still a mega market that exists out there, and I hope that maybe we'll be lucky enough. Because you know what? Capcom has, a lot of people were very, very understandably critical of Capcom for a long time, and it seems like now they're doing very, very good stuff. And people are a lot happier with them, and you know. So, who knows?
These last 2 years has been really quite good in the content. Mm. I feel like they just want to punish people because Keiji Ifune left. Ifune, whatever.
Inafune.
Yeah, I was so disappointed when they canceled Legends 3. That was the only reason I even bought a 3DS. And then it was like, what? I was waiting for the demo. Nintendo was like, the demo's going to come out right during E3. Yeah. I was getting ready. I was like, is it there yet?
I mean, Inafune-san's off doing his own thing. And, you know, it seems like the fact that we've had a resurgence of Capcom, of Mega Man stuff from Capcom, it seems like maybe some of that smoke is clearing a little bit. I would like to hope. I mean, you know, we'll never know like the full details of those relationships and politics and everything. Like, it's not our business to know, unfortunately. But I'm hopeful. You know what? At the very least, I'm grateful for a Battle Network Legacy Collection because I was so happy to get to play those games again and share them with a whole generation of people that didn't get to play them before. I love Venti Warrior and all that stuff. But to hear Andrew Francis as Mega Man of the Menu System again was such a joy. So you know what? Like, there's you take the good as, you know, where you can get it, and I'm hopeful maybe we'll get some stuff. That, and also, I mean, like, not Capcom related, but it's just like I'm still over here being like, we're getting a Mario RPG remake. What is my life like? Oh, it's real. Like, wow. So
I have loads of retro things I wish they would bring back, but you know. You're right. There are these remakes. There does seem to be more recognition that this is a viable market. So who knows? One comment I really liked, and this is kind of one thing I wanted to say for this interview, you made in the Pipkin, the bun, in her interview, she was asking you about, you know, like how actors or voice actors are very shell, because you guys were talking about theater kid energy. And you made the comment that you said, actually, people generally have it wrong, that they think that people who are actors or voice actors in entertainment, that they're very dramatic and that they're very fake. But your point was actually it's the opposite. The issue here is that they feel almost too much. They're very much into these things. And so that kind of comes off differently to people. Could you, if you're comfortable, could you expound upon that? Because it's so interesting, because you started like me. You're like a big fan. And now you're working all the things that you kind of wanted to be sort of involved in. And you're getting to do all the things. But you also get to meet the real people, the actual story underneath it all. And so hearing your insights to what that is actually like, getting to live your dream, is really interesting to me. I think maybe it's interesting to my audience as well.
I think it goes back to the same thing I was talking earlier about, like, everybody has a misconception about, like, oh, it's, you know, it's all nepotism, but it's like, no, it's a community. I think that the fakeness, people that are really, like, genuinely fake, like, just, jerks, they don't last long, you know, no matter how talented they might be. They're if that's the energy that they give off, people don't want to work with them, you know. I think that most people I've met in this business, even just specifically voiceover, are so kind and so cool, and they're good friends. And yeah, what I was kind of joking about was that, like, no, I don't think anybody's fake. If anything, most of the people that I know get really, and myself included, get so real. You know, I just met, I was at a party a couple days ago. I met Bill Millsap, who's a great voice director. I'd never met him before. And he's as a voice actor as well. He's worked on JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. And, like, I met him and his partner for, like, all of 10 minutes. And we're already talking about, like, deeply personal things. And I'm like, wow. And there's a part of me that's thinking, like, am I getting, like, way too real having known this person for, like, you know, a millisecond? But no, it was, like, very comfortable and, you know, et cetera. And it was nice that, like, sometimes you have those kind of just immediate connections to people, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's maybe also a certain perception, because even I see this sometimes, is, like, when people go to conventions, there's a level of, like, have to be, like, ultra, ultra, ultra respectful and empathetic to everyone, because and I don't see that as, like, oh, I have to put a face on, I have to be fake or whatever. I think it's out of, you just want to be very respectful and kind and grateful to fans, you know. I could understand, say, if, like, you know, I try to be pretty real with people when I meet them at cons and stuff, but, like, If I was like, hi, it's great to meet you. Oh, thank you so much for watching my show. I could understand, like, looking at that and being like, are you just, like, being hyper polite to me right now? Because, like, are you on, like, some sort of pedestal and, like, I'm below you or whatever? I could see people maybe interpreting that in a different way. But I think that it's just because, like, and there's been so many cases where sometimes, like, okay, here's a case of people being too real. If, like, you get, like, a celebrity and they're just like, all right, yeah, whatever. Here's my autograph. All right, next. You know, like, that's, yeah, they're being real, but they're not being very nice, you know? And those are also, I think that those are pretty rare cases personally. Like, most people are just about things. But also, on even maybe a grander scale than everything I'm saying, is, like, it's just different from person to person, you know? Like, I'm generalizing a lot from my personal experience, because most people I've interacted with are just cool. You know, and very, and it goes back to, again, it's like when I was, you know, assembling everybody for the Tome, you know, the web series and the video game and et cetera, it was all just people that I could call up and be like, you down to work on this thing? It's like, yeah, done, the end, right? And that came from those friendships and those relationships being built up for all that time, you know? Mm-hmm. And I look at that and I think that that's great. So, but that's my personal experience. Everybody has a different one. There are some people, like, actually a friend of mine who was just kind of, like, sick of it. He was just like, I think I want to move away from LA. I just am not happy here. I'm like, that's totally fine, man. Like, if you're going to be happier somewhere else with your wife, you can be away from all this and maybe still work from home if you, you know, if you get opportunities. Great. Absolutely. But there's nothing wrong with, like, I would be sad that your personal experience is like you're not enjoying the dynamic out here and it doesn't make you happy. But that's also valid to not want to be part of it because that's your personal experience, you know? And I got some flack from like Pippa's chat during that part where everybody's like, God, you're so neutralist, or, oh, like, why wouldn't you let my plug it? But that's like, and I like, you know what? I get where that comes from too, but it's like that really is my thought, is I'm just like, I just try to have fun and I just try to enjoy myself. And the people that I see the most that are my close friends that are, you know, in this entertainment world are people that I trust a lot. And we all just want to have a good time and do good work and hopefully pay the bills. So
I agree. I think your approach is right. The one thing I do love about voice acting, and I have major respect for people who are like this, because you're in your position, you play Reagan, and maybe there's someone out there that's having a really hard time, or they see your performance, they watch the show, it really sticks with them. And they like, oh, I'm so excited to meet him at the, I'm going to see Chris at the con. I really want to tell him how much he, you know, all the stuff that he meant to me. And of course, you've never met that person. That's a lot of things to put on you. So of course, you want to be friendly. You want to be polite because you don't know what your interaction is going to mean to that person. But doing that kind of thing isn't necessarily for everyone. I think one of the things that I've learned working in journalism, and I didn't understand this when I was younger, yes, there is trolling. Yes, there are people that are playing for clicks. But I think the problem we're seeing, even with the culture war and all the tension we see at places like Twitter, there's this assumption that the other side doesn't actually believe or doesn't really feel the things that they're saying or doing. When that's not the truth. In my experience, that's why journalists sometimes get offended if people make a negative comment. It's not because they're fake. It's because they're very real and they feel it. And I wish if people approached it more like you were saying, where you're mindful of like how we see each other may not be the same. What values we might take away from each other might be the same, and show a little bit of kindness. I think that would change things a lot. And that is something I've noticed along with voice acting that I really appreciate. And maybe it's because a lot of voice actors came, you know, you've said multiple times, like how you were bullied as a kid. And so maybe those experiences taught you to be more empathetic, but it's something I kind of wish there was a lot more of in the world, just personally and professionally.
I do too. But you know what? It's funny. Like I see often this comment, this is a recent epiphany I had where people are like, why can't everybody just be good to each other? Is it so difficult to be a good person? And it's like, you know what? Yes, it takes work to be a good person. It takes effort and energy to be a good person. And like, what I consider, I think people throw on like bad person a little too. Bad people are like, you know, serial killers and criminals, mm-hmm. and, you know, et cetera. Like, to me, most people are just people, you know, most of them are just people. And then you meet like really, really good people that are just super like giving and altruistic and wonderful. And they're the dime a dozen, but that's what makes them like really special, like, you know, connections that you have in your life is when you meet those people. And I think it's the same thing. It's like, we just do our best to be good. Sometimes it isn't enough. Or, you know, whoever is in our peripheral, but you just try, you know. Some people just get tired and they don't, and then they just kind of live. And if that's easy for them, then that's okay. But anything can be as difficult as you make it to be. And you never know what anybody's personal, you know, shoes that they walk in. You know, you have no idea. You know, you just have to be understanding and go through your own, the best of your own ability. That's what I've always, you know, tried to do for 34 years of existence. That's what I want to continue to do for the, however, 120 something more years of existence.
Yes, yes. Hopefully. You said 150, like
So I'd be choreographer 150. There we go. In due time.
No, that's very much a Reagan. That's like one of my favorite things about Reagan, where he gives the speech to mob. And it's like psychic powers aren't any different than anyone else. You know, because that was a great thing, because I was fishing season one, and Reagan, when he has that big climactic battle, his big message to everyone, and that's kind of like the theme of the whole mob cycle, really. And then is like, people want to feel like they are so different, that we're so above everything. But the truth is, we're all humans. We're all in the middle of it. And that's just kind of something you have to learn and accept. It's kind of the beauty of life, but, you know.
And you're the protagonist of your own life.
That's right. That's right.
Eats his burger.
He's always so, especially when he eats, like they eat like any kind of like burger thing. And in Japan, they do have like the burgers that come in the bags.
Yeah.
We don't really have here, but they have all the stuff around their face.
Yeah.
That always bugs me. I have a little bit of inclination to like go clean yourself up. Well, this was so much fun. I really appreciate this, Chris.
Yeah, of course.
What is next for you? What are you want to do another thing with Tome, I think I've read. What are your projects and things you want to do on the horizon?
My last little thing for Tome coming up. When is this interview going live, do you think?
Probably 2 weeks.
Okay, so well, by the time this will be out, I will have released the third and final installment of the Tome A2Z trilogy, which was a series of movies where I took the episodes of the Tome 2011 web series and compiled them into three films with new footage. This recent one actually has an all-new expanded ending that takes place further after where the show ended. So you can check that out. I'm going to be uploading the old episodes of TTA on my YouTube channel at some point as well. So that'll be something to look back on. I would like to do a new Super Mario RPG music video, and that's going to be cool to do. I'm in talks with a few people about getting that off the ground at some point. So, I'm writing on a new project that's coming up, which I'm excited about, and also I'm in early stages of developing a movie. An animated feature film, which is going to be hopefully my next kind of like big project. It's called Balancing Act. And it's like my big magnum opus thing. And otherwise, and you know, hopefully if I'm lucky, more voiceover stuff. We'll see. So that's about all. And hopefully getting my body fixed because I injured myself a lot a couple of years ago. And I'm still trying to work through that. So maybe if I'm lucky, my arms will work again like normal.
Oh, yeah, you need to take good care of yourself. Have you ever worked on a voiceover project and then you actually, like, met the creator? I know that I've heard the people that worked in One Piece did have an opportunity to talk to Oda-san, but I don't know if I've heard that very often. That might have been true of Cowboy Bebop as well, but I could be wrong.
I mean, well, with OKKO, the creator, Ian, was in the room with us because he was in the show as voices,
yeah, but he's
course.
American. Yeah. He lives in L.A.
For Japanese creators, I don't think so. Yeah, never the creator, no. I remember when I worked on Gundam Origin, I met one of the head producers from Sunrise, one of the Japanese producers, I think at Otakon, and I spoke with him about, someday I'd love to... If you guys ever do like a remake of the original Mobile Suit Gundam, I'd love to, you know, do more stuff with Garma. And he was like, you do know that Garma dies. And I'm like, I want to go out in a blaze of glory. Like, I'm excited, you know?
He was terrified. Like, oh my gosh, he doesn't know.
That's all I know. I want to be like,
let me just see on.
And then, you know, crash and burn and then set the rest of the show in motion. But I mean, good Lord, I don't think this will never happen, but I mean, if I ever got to meet Oda-san or Akira Toriyama sensei, I mean, I would be losing my mind, you know, just for how much of an influence they've been on me, you know? But you know what? In the meantime, just getting to work on their shows, like, that's enough for me. So
okay.
I'm very supremely honored.
There is Reigen Arataka material that can be adapted. So if you ever do see, for some reason, you fall into a wormhole and you end up meeting one, like, get on that.
I mean, I know that there's like a Reigen manga that takes place like after the end of the series. I mean, if they ever were to do like an OVA or something of that, I would be all in on that. That'd be great. But who knows? We'll see. Maybe someday if I'm so lucky.
Okay. Well, I think you have many good things in front of you. I felt like when I listened to that Pipkin, I watch her regularly, so I don't understand why. I was gonna say, one of the things I kind of felt from you were you're kind of hard on yourself a little bit. You're like you feel like, and you know, this happens to a lot of us when we get in our 30s. You're like, that's it, I peaked. But I don't think that's the case.
No, I don't feel like I peaked. I'm hard on myself. Like, I'm wearing like the weighted training clothes. Like, I'm a Dragon Ball character, always in training. But no. I don't think I've peaked. I mean, like, I'm proud of a lot of these big things that I've gotten to do, but I always want to strive for something bigger and better. And, you know, and I can only hope that I'll be successful in that. But, you know, but in the meantime, I just try to enjoy everything, you know, and the journey along the way to, you know, maybe that big success. So,
okay. Well, I hope that's true for all of us. You can, yeah. of course, find Mr. Christopher Kerbifer. There we go.
There you go.
He has a YouTube channel, which you can find by either typing in Chris Neosi or Kerbifer. You're on Twitter, also Kerbifer. You have your, I don't know if your website is Kerbifer.
So I have on Twitter, I'm at Kerbifer. On YouTube, I'm Kerbifer 15 because I made it when I was 15. I am also Kerbifer 15 on TikTok because I've been doing some stuff on there as well. And my website is chrisneosi.net, which has a whole bunch of stuff that you can check out. It's got voice demos and stuff about Tome and all sorts of things. Yeah, that's where you can find me all over the place. And, thanks everybody for listening. I hope that this was entertaining somewhat.
I'm sure I get good feedback all the time. People really seem to enjoy these interviews. They're a bit more long form to hear from people. So I appreciate you taking the time. You guys, if you haven't watched Tome, go watch Tome. It's pretty fun. I think it's
In fact, if you haven't seen it before, please check out by now there will be a playlist of the Tome A to Z trilogy of compilation movies. It's a great way to get into the series if you've never seen it before. Just, you know, in a time of binging that we have now. And if you want to check out the Terrain of Magical Expertise video game on Steam as well, you can go find that. There's links to that all over all my sites and everything. Peter, thank you for bringing me on. This was a joy. And
me
yeah,
too.
So
I enjoy it as well, sir.
I enjoy myself as well. So.
All right, everyone. Well, this has been fun. Thank you so much for listening. This podcast and YouTube show is helped sponsored and produced by Bain Books Publishing and Young Voices, a journalism organization. Thank you to my wonderful editor, Christopher, different Chris, for all the hard work he puts in. He makes me look much smarter, much more competent than I actually am. And thank you to all you viewers for listening and watching. Until next time, my friends, keep geeking out.